the perverse logic of Platonism would have it that there is something inherently undemocratic about the proposition that wealth should belong to the majority who produce it rather than the idle minority who own the means of creating it. To suggest that the world and everything in it should belong to dockers and dustmen, teachers and office workers, nurses and miners, factory machinists, to the working class who produce the wealth of the world, is dismissed by the Reagans and the Thatchers and the Foots and the Andropovs as a conception of democracy which is at best naive and at worst subversive. Capitalism cannot cope with democracy any more than religion can cope with science. Indeed, there are vicars who approvingly quote from Darwin and claim to indulge in moments of rationality between their prayers, just as there are capitalists who like the sound of equality between the rich and the poor and pontificate occasionally about schemes to allow the inmates of progressive prisons to elect their own governors. But the democratisation of the profit system is an illusory project, because the class monopoly of capital can never be amenable to majority decision-making. Those who own property control it. To leave ownership in the hands of a privileged minority and then pass control to the dispossessed majority, which is the objective of capitalist democracy, is bound to be a failure. Of course, these lessons about how essentially undemocratic capitalism is are not learned without experience. Before workers could know the barriers of capitalist liberty, they had to test them out. And in testing them out, they were bound to confront the tyranny of the privileged, who will only smile at you as long as you are prepared to leave them alone. This lecture is about the first mass movement of the working class, which sought to test the democratic potential of the capitalist system. I'm going to show how that movement failed in its bid to democratise the capitalist state in the interest of the working class. But in particular, what I want to consider is the wing of that mass movement, the Chartist movement, which was associated with men like Bronte O'Brien and, to a lesser extent, George Harney and Ernest Jones. And I will show how these workers made the important and vital political leap from political to social democracy. How they went beyond asking for political reform of the system and began to ask for a social rearrangement of society. The fundamental political contention of this lecture should be stated explicitly right now at the beginning. It's far too often lectures are given by people outside of the Socialist Party, and you never find out what their political message is until they finish giving it, and normally long after that. The contention is that there can be no worthwhile struggle for meaningful democracy which is not also a struggle for the new social system of socialism. The anti-socialist democrat is a fake. The undemocratic nature of capitalism is not a myth which has been invented by Karl Marx or the Socialist Party of Great Britain. Until relatively recently, the spokesmen for capital were quite open about the fact that the running of their system was for the wealth owners and not the wealth producers. Consider, for example, the words of Jeremiah Dyson, MP, when confronted in 1770 by the proposition that workers should be given the vote. This is what he said. "I am an enemy to tyranny, sir, and therefore I cannot without indignation hear this House threatened with the most preposterous of all tyranny, that of a mob, to insinuate that the measures of a legislative body should be influenced by the rabble is to insinuate that all government should be at an end." According to Edmund Burke, who was another spokesman concerned with preserving the access to the state to those who own property, he said, "The sovereignty of the people was the most false, wicked and mischievous doctrine that ever could be preached to them. The moment that equality and the sovereignty of the people was adopted as the rule of government, property would be at an end." The essence of these remarks is that those who have power over property must have power over the state, that is to say, the government and the armed forces. But this power does not remain static. As the 18th century closed, a sharp division emerged between those who owned wealth in the form of land and those who had accumulated vast amounts of industrial capital during the Industrial Revolution in the latter part of the 18th century. This class struggle, which to some extent was a mighty battle between competing factions within the ruling class, had the byproduct of creating a new ideological language, a political vocabulary arising out of the class aspirations of the emergent industrial capitalists. They resented the oligarchic privileges of the entrenched aristocracy. All this talk about divine right, the privilege of the aristocracy. Seeing these as feudal remnants, the aspirant industrial capitalists spouted the rhetoric of liberal democracy. They argued the case for equality and freedom and fraternity and liberalism within the state. The deceptive promise of freedom under capitalism won supporters to the industrial capitalists from within the working class. In 1832, when the Tory-dominated House of Lords persistently blocked the Whig Reform Act, which was intended to extend the right to vote to the industrial capitalists while leaving the working class disenfranchised, this caused thousands of workers to riot in the streets, demanding that the House of Lords allow the industrial capitalists to gain their access into Parliament. It was their tragically misplaced hope that by helping their economic masters to political ascendancy, they would be repaid in kind. And they were repaid in kind after the industrial capitalists gained control of Parliament. They were repaid by the setting up of the barbaric workhouses which punish the workers for the crime of being destitute and the tyrannical rule over the system of exploitation by the exploiting class, which was the hallmark of 19th century control of Parliament by industrial capitalists. Having climbed to power on the backs of the working class, the new industrial capitalist rulers decided that it was on the workers' backs that they would stay. Disappointment and anger with Whig rule was not the only impetus for the emergence of the new working class movement of Chartism. The early 19th century also witnessed the development of a number of ideas which began to explain the wretchedness and inequality of the new industrial system. Indeed, the critics who objected to capitalism and tried to explain it were often motivated by moral indignation rather than materialist class analysis. Some of them were utopians and seekers after the revival of the old aristocratic conditions. Most of them proposed no serious alternative to the system which they so eloquently and ably attacked. But an examination of what they said is nonetheless valuable, because great ideas, including that of socialism, do not emerge complete from the minds of geniuses, however much, incidentally, the Marx worshippers might suggest that that is so. They develop dialectically out of earlier ideas and experiences and experiments, and socialism didn't come ready-made. It grew out of these earlier, to some extent, utopian criticisms. Three thinkers can be briefly considered. The first is Thomas Hodgkin, who was a retired naval officer. He took his starting point at the labour theory of value, as explained not by Karl Marx, but by the man who earlier formulated it from a capitalist point of view, David Ricardo. According to this theory, which was later to be the main political economy of Marxism, labour is the source of all value. This was a fundamental break in economic theory. It was labour which was the source of wealth, labour which was the source of value. Hodgkin's conclusion was quite simple. If labour creates the wealth and its value, why should not labour receive its full fruits rather than having a system where workers only receive back a part of what they produce, the remainder going to the capitalist in the form of rent, interest and profit? In 1825, Hodgkin wrote a book called Labour Defended Against the Claims of Capital, in which he outlined the principal arguments of what later began to be called Ricardian socialism. A quotation from that book is in order now.
Before a labourer can have a loaf of bread, he must give a quantity of labour more than the loaf costs. By all that quantity which pays the profit of the farmer, the corn dealer, the miller and the baker, with profit on all the buildings they use. And he must, moreover, pay with the produce of his labour the rent of the landlord. Whether there are corn laws or not, the capitalist must allow the labourer to subsist. And as long as his claims are granted and acted on, he will never allow him to do more. I am certain, however, that till the triumph of labour be complete, till productive industry alone be opulent, until idleness alone be poor, till the admirable maxim that he who sows shall reap be solidly established, till the right of property shall be founded on the principles of justice and not on those of slavery, till man shall be held more in honour than the clod he treads on or the machine he guides, there cannot and there ought not to be either peace on earth or goodwill amongst men.
So that was Hodgkin. Very interesting stuff. But he was only a critic. He was only a critic of capitalism. Hodgkin, when it came to providing an alternative, argued that there should be a society based upon the free competition between independent producers, a kind of a small-scale, backward-looking capitalism. That's because that's as far as his particular political vision went. It was another thinker in the same period, William Thompson, who was the first to argue a case for what he called mutual cooperation and equal distribution. It was one of the first major outlines of the socialist idea in British conditions. In 1826, William Thompson wrote a book called Labour Rewarded. He specially chose that title because Hodgkin called his Labour Defended, and he wanted to call his Labour Rewarded. He wanted to look at the alternatives to capitalism. And here we have an example, 20 years before Marx was publishing his earliest analyses of capitalist economics, of Thompson explaining the essential economic contradictions of the profit system. Listen to it now, and by and large, what Thompson had to say about capitalism that long ago is something which was a strikingly original and innovative analysis.
How comes it that a nation abounding more than any other in the rude materials of wealth, in machinery, dwellings and food, in intelligent and industrious producers, with all the apparent means of happiness, with all the outward semblances of happiness exhibited by a small and rich portion of the community, should still pine in privation? How comes it that the fruits of the labour of the industrious, after years of incessant and successful exertion, are mysteriously and without imputation of fault to them, without any convulsion of nature, swept away? Why is it that the system enriches the few at the expense of the mass of producers, to make the poverty of the poor more helpless, to throw back the middling classes upon the poor, that a few may be enabled not only to accumulate in perniciously large masses the national capital, but also by means of such accumulations to command the products of the yearly labour of the community? The idle possessor of the inanimate instruments of production not only secures to himself by their possession as much enjoyment as the most diligent and skilful of the real efficient producers, but in proportion to the amount of his accumulations, by whatever means acquired, he produces 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times as much of the articles of wealth, the product of labour and the means of enjoyment, as the utmost labour of such efficient producers can procure for them.
There you are. Well, this is all very good, basically socialist stuff. Sounds like Ron on the outdoor platform, that sort of thing. So, coinciding with these insights into capitalism, and to some extent preceding them as well, there occurred plans for utopian socialist communities. The greatest thinker behind these was undoubtedly the capitalist Robert Owen, who engaged in some well-meant but ultimately futile attempts to create small communal islands of socialism within the ocean of the profit system. After the failure of these projects, Owen turned to a primitive form of syndicalism. These syndicalist ideas were to argue that if only the workers could form one grand union, a union taking in every worker in the land, a combination of the entire labouring class, the capitalists would be bound to defer to the wishes of the wealth producers. Owen formed this. He formed the Grand National Consolidated Trades Union, and he won hundreds of thousands of workers to its ranks. It was by far the biggest working class movement that had ever been known up until that time. And what happened? The bosses owned the means of production. The union members in the Grand National were told that they must either leave or face lockouts. Some of them attempted to fight against this. In Derby there was a strike which lasted for about 5 months of the building workers, but they couldn't. The majority of the union membership crumbled and the masters won the day. But of course, every defeat for the working class provides its own lesson. The failure of this early form of syndicalism led many workers in the direction of the new political democratic ideas. They began to think that they couldn't deal with things purely in an industrial form. They had to start trying to do it in a political one. For example, the first political weekly newspaper of the working class in Manchester, which is called The Voice of the People, announced in its first issue in January 1831 that, I quote, "Labour is the source of wealth. The working men are the support of the middle and upper classes. They are the nerves and soul of the process of production, and therefore of the nation." Now, it's a first principle of exerting political strength that one should know how strong one is to start with. And by the early 1830s, the British working class was beginning to test its strength, beginning to find out what it could do, and just as importantly, what it could not do. There's one other factor which helped workers in Britain to find out their own strength, something which happened across the sea. This was the experience of the French Revolution. Here they had seen how history could be made by ordinary people, how by gathering together, spreading ideas, publishing pamphlets, holding meetings, you could shake and remove a seemingly irremovable establishment and depose the highest of powers. So, by the beginning of the 19th century, workers began to meet and talk and plan. Where did they meet? For many of them, it was in the mechanics institutes that were growing up in the 1830s, places of working class self-instruction. But for many more, it was above pubs very much like this, in rooms very much like this, with talks very much like this. And just like socialists today, they would enthuse about the coming changes, and they would move resolutions, and they would move amendments, and not infrequently, they would shout out of turn when somebody else was talking. Probably Chairman knows all about that. And in his passages in the life of a radical, Samuel Bamford, a Lancashire weaver, he gives a vivid account of one of these early working class radical meetings. And it's worth hearing it. And anyone in the Socialist Party of Great Britain will have more than a slight sense of déjà vu.
"Every man would have his half pint of porter before him. Many would be speaking at once, and the hum and confusion would be such as gave an idea of there being more talkers than thinkers, more speakers than listeners. Presently order would be called, and comparative silence would ensue. A speaker, stranger or citizen, would be announced with much courtesy and compliment. Hear, hear, hear would follow, with clapping of hands and knocking of knuckles on the table till the half finds done. Then a speech with compliments to some brother, orator, or popular statesman. Next, a resolution in favour of parliamentary reform, and a speech to second it. An amendment on some minor point would follow, a seconding of that. A breach of order by some individual of warm temperament, half a dozen would rise to set him right, a dozen to put him down, and the vociferation and gesticulation would become loud and confounding.
Sounds like the EC or a
Well, it was out of such a meeting in the early 1830s that the National Union of the Working Classes was formed, and that was formed in 1831. Out of the National Union of the Working Classes emerged the London Working Men's Association. And out of that emerged the famous six-point charter, which provided the basis for the democratic movement, which was to dominate working-class radicalism for nearly two decades. Now, it's tempting to go on to give a history of Chartism, but such an exercise would miss the theme which I want to concentrate upon this evening. As a movement, Chartism was an alliance. It contained bankers in Birmingham who wanted parliamentary reform because they wanted currency reform. It contained people like Fergus O'Connor, who, as well as wanting political reform, was also particularly concerned about British policy in Ireland. It contained people like William Lovett, who solely wanted to confine himself to political changes and not to social ones. It contained a group which met in London who were known as the Rotundists. And that group within the Chartists, they argued that there should be some degree of social reform, but they weren't very clear about what it should be. Indeed, it would be untrue to deny that the Chartist movement was dominated by those sections of it which were primarily concerned with a very limited reform of the franchise. But there were others in it. These others were a minority, certainly. They were vague, perhaps, in some of their views. But these Chartists were embryonic socialists, and it is their major contribution to the development of socialist thought, to which I want to spend time concentrating on this evening. But first, let me just deal with two things. The main aim of the Chartists was universal manhood suffrage. In short, the vote for all men. This, they argued, would allow workers to have access to political control. I've already pointed out that the ruling class could never grant access to political power and still be sure of the security of their property. So they resisted the three great Chartist petitions of 1839, 1842, and 1848. In 1842, when the biggest of the petitions was sent to Parliament, only 42 votes could be scraped up in Parliament, even to hear the petition being read. In 1848, when there was a supposed mass demonstration of the Chartists at Kennington Common in South London, the police and militia sent thousands and thousands of their ranks along to try to outmanoeuvre the demonstrators. And Chartism ended by the end of the 1840s without having won its objective. Speaking in Parliament against the 1842 petition, Macaulay made quite clear why votes for workers was something that was simply not acceptable. And it's worth hearing Macaulay's reason for opposing giving the vote to workers.
I am opposed to universal suffrage. I conceive that civilization rests on the security of property. Therefore, we can never, without absolute danger, entrust the supreme government of the country to any class which would, to a moral certainty, commit great and systematic inroads against the security of property. The petition asks for supreme power. In every constituent body throughout the empire, capital and accumulated property is to be placed absolutely at the foot of labour. How is it possible to doubt what the result will be?
So Chartism failed. The ruling class would not have any of it. And arising out of this failure to obtain democratic reform of capitalism, it's claimed by conventional historians of Chartism that what they call the left wing of the movement abandoned the struggle for the vote for other pursuits, such as a general strike and, in particular, violent insurrections. And several modern leftists who reject the idea of change through the ballot box because they are fundamentally undemocratic and do not believe in the idea of majority transformation of society, they see this so-called left wing of Chartism as having taken the correct, more revolutionary road. Well, it's worth considering where this road led. It is indeed true that the failure of the Chartist petitions aroused feelings of desperation amongst the Chartist organisers. You've got to realise that after these petitions failed, the state responded with brutality, which certainly hasn't been experienced in any of our lifetimes here. It responded by imprisoning hundreds and hundreds of Chartists, including, incidentally, Bronte O'Brien. Young, impulsive men within the movement began to devise schemes for nationwide insurrection. George Harney, who was a devoted admirer of the French Jacobin Marat, wrote in the London Democrat in April 1839,
"Men of the East and West, men of the North and South, your success lies with yourselves. Depend upon yourselves alone and your cause will be triumphant. The 6th of May is approaching. Prepare, prepare, prepare. Listen not to the men who would preach delay. In the 2 or 3 weeks you have remaining, let me exhort you to arm. I mean you that are yet unarmed. For oh, thank God, that tens of thousands of you can now assert your right to be free men. To you that are not so prepared, I say again, arm to protect your aged parents. Arm for your wives and children. Arm for your sweethearts and sisters. Arm to drive tyranny from the soil and oppression from the judgment seat. Your country, your posterity, your God demands of you to arm, arm, arm. Come then, men of the north, from your snow-capped hills. Come then, men of the south, from your sunlit valleys. Come to the gathering. Unite, fraternize, arm, and you will be free."
Well, as you can imagine, George Harvey wrote that when he was just about to fall asleep one night. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous stuff. It's dangerous stuff, and it's repeated again now, because workers began to listen to it. Desperate workers who felt that they couldn't ever get access to the state, they could never get democracy, they began to take him up, and they began to arm. And in Newport, in South Wales, the Chartist John Frost led a pitiful failure of an insurrection. Hoping that rumours of gathering working-class armies in Bradford, Birmingham and all over Wales were true, Frost led several thousand Monmouthshire miners in an attempt to seize Newport by a night attack. Rain delayed the insurrectionaries arriving at Newport, and the government troops, who were safely sheltered in the Westgate Hotel, fired on the marchers as they entered into Newport. For 20 minutes... the miners tried to storm the hotel, and they did not give up until 14 of them were shot down and many more were injured. 125 workers were subsequently arrested, and after the Newport Rising, the state had the reason it had been waiting for, to stamp down hard on the Chartist movement, rounding them up, locking them up, and preventing them from taking any kind of organisational work. So the modern daydream insurrectionaries of the left would do very well to learn the lesson of the Newport Rising, because the failure of such adventures is not simply that people are disappointed, it is of course that people are killed. But to see such a policy as being the contribution of the Chartist socialists, as many historians would call it, the left wing of Chartism, is to misunderstand the thinking of that wing of the movement, and in particular of men like Bronte O'Brien. Now, as so little has been written about O'Brien, let me give you some of the details about him. He was born in Longford in Ireland in 1803. His father was a merchant who went bankrupt during Bronte's childhood and soon afterwards died of poverty. O'Brien, who was an outstanding mathematician when he was at school, got a job teaching in a public school at Edgeworth. And after that, he went on to Trinity College Dublin. There he gained a scholarship to go to the University of London and study law. Having a desire to see social change, O'Brien soon became bored by the sterility of legal studies, and he became acquainted with the two most prominent London radicals of the time, William Cobbett and the famous Orator Hunt, the great speaker of the early radical movement. And as O'Brien later wrote, "I came to London to study law and radical reform. My friend sent me to study law. I took to radical reform on my own account. Having a natural love of truth and as natural a hatred of falsehood, I soon got sick of law and I gave all my soul to radical reform. I feel as though every drop of my blood, I feel as though every drop of blood in my vein was radical blood, and as if the very food I swallowed undergoes a process of radicalisation." Well, we know how he felt. What was the essence, then, of Bronte O'Brien's radicalism? In October 1830, the radical publisher Henry Hetherington appointed O'Brien as the editor of a new journal. This was to be a journal which was to be unique for the times, in those times, I should say, because it avoided the Stamp Act, which had been legislated by Lord Liverpool's government in order to make all publications out of the reach of working class people. Because if a journal didn't cost sevenpence, it couldn't have a stamp. The Poor Man's Guardian, which was the journal formed by Hetherington and O'Brien, was sold defiantly at the price of one penny. And each issue had written on the front, "We do not pay the Stamp Act. We are here to prove that right is greater than might." In this journal, which lasted for 5 years, O'Brien developed a theoretical critique of the profit system, which won many adherents within the Chartist movement, who wanted to go beyond political reform towards social transformation. And I would argue that this wing of the Chartist movement, small though it was, and not particularly distinct though it was, this wing were the direct political ancestors in the British working class movement of the revolutionary socialists of today. In October 1833, the Poor Man's Guardian reported that, quote, "A spirit of combination has grown up among the working class of which there has been no example in former times. A grand national organisation which promises to embody the physical power of the country is silently but rapidly progressing, and the object of it is the sublimest that can be conceived, namely, to establish for the productive classes a complete domination over the fruits of their own industry." In other words, early ideas of socialism, and they were spreading fast. The best way to demonstrate the clarity of political understanding on the part of Bronte O'Brien and the Poor Man's Guardian is to let you hear some of what O'Brien wrote. To begin with, O'Brien rejected the myth, which is still prevalent today, that the problems of the working class are somehow attributable to human nature. O'Brien wrote, "All the crimes and superstitions of human nature have their origin in this cannibal warfare of riches against poverty. The desire of one man to live on the fruits of another's labour is the original sin of the world." Unlike those radicals who saw the inequality of capitalism as being caused by corrupt individuals and bad governments, Bronte O'Brien took a class analysis of politics. He was the first radical thinker in Britain to do so, in a sense. He wrote, "The error which appears to us to be one of the most formidable barriers to human improvement is that of imputing to individuals the glory and the guilt of those political acts and systems of government which are in reality the work of whole classes, and in the execution of which the individuals are but the chosen tools or instruments of these classes." Now, it's not only the correctness of these ideas that I'm pointing towards, but it is the remarkable fact that they were published in Britain in 1835, 8 years before Marx wrote his first significant work and a decade and a half before anything of Marx's was published in Britain. Unlike those radicals who were taken in by the fraud of the 1832 Parliamentary Reform Act, O'Brien and the Poor Man's Guardian rejected the view that workers should assist their capitalist masters in their political ambitions. The cause of workers must be kept separate from that of the capitalist middle class, said O'Brien. The Poor Man's Guardian referred to the 1832 bill, which workers were being urged to riot in the streets in support of, as, quote, a wicked, tyrannous, dishonest, and diabolical measure. O'Brien warned those workers who were campaigning to give the vote to their masters that, quote, you will be starved to death by thousands if this bill passes, and thrown onto the dunghill or onto the ground, naked like dogs. And when you consider the growth of the workhouses which were enacted after 1834 by their political masters, that is not wrong. The anti-working class policies of the Whig government only attracted more and more support towards O'Brien's section of the Chartist movement. The Poor Man's Guardian had no doubts about the class nature of the capitalist state. They did not need Marx to tell them that the state was nothing more than the executive committee of the ruling class. Look at what Bronco O'Brien wrote about it. Up to this moment, he wrote, all governments of the world have been nothing but conspiracies of rich against poor, of the strong and cunning to keep in subjection the weak and ignorant. The present government of England is of this sort. And we need only echo that. The present government of England is of this sort. So like the Socialist Party today, O'Brien realised the importance of the vote. He realised, in the same way that the Socialist Party expresses this, and our particular expression of this in the Declaration of Principles of this party, in the sixth clause, shows very clearly the case for democratic revolution. And I quote what that is. That as the machinery of government, including the armed forces of the nation, exists only to conserve the monopoly by the capitalist class of the wealth taken from the workers, the working class must organise consciously and democratically for the conquest of the powers of government, national and local, in order that this machinery, including these forces, may be converted from an instrument of oppression into the agent of emancipation. And it is for this reason, the same one as the principles of the SPGB, that O'Brien opposed the claim of the Owenites that industrial combination, the forming trade unions, can eradicate the essential contradictions of capitalism. For Bronte O'Brien, trade unions were at best defensive bodies, but they could not change society unless they adopted political aims. As he wrote in 1834,
the trade unions have combined for objects of practical utility. We hail these coalitions as among the most glorious signs of the times. But it is one thing to conclave, and another to effect the objects of the combination. To effect these, something more is required than the mere power of a strike. What do the trade unions seek? Increase of wages and diminution of the hours of labour. Who does not see that this is to attack property? To attack property is to attack robbery. But how are we to attack it in the safest and most expeditious manner? We cannot attack it by law, for the property class holds the law in its own hand. In our opinion, the trade unions have hit upon the best way of striking property on the head, provided only that they add universal suffrage to their present avowed objects.
But what Bronte O'Brien and his embryonic socialist wing of the Chartist movement were after was not the vote for the vote's sake. They weren't in favour of democracy as an abstract ideal. Workers needed the vote in order to establish a new social order. And Bronte O'Brien was very clear about this. In fact, it was he who formulated the slogan of his wing of the Chartist movement, which was called the Charter and Something More. In other words, not just the vote, but beyond the vote, what are you going to do with it? O'Brien may not have been fully aware of how such a new social order could be organised. He may indeed not have been particularly clear about the process of revolutionary change. He was undoubtedly very much influenced by working class ideas which had been prevalent during the French Revolution, and particularly the conspiratorial ideas of Babeuf. But he certainly never tired of explaining the case against private property and the democratic method by which its abolition could be sought. He was a democrat and understood that the transformation of society in the interest of the majority had to be carried out by the majority, just as socialists are saying today. As you know, by the end of the 1840s, the Chartist movement was crushed. Many of its organisers were languishing prisons. Lovett fell prey to the disillusion which had intellectually destroyed so many radicals. Fergus O'Connor, the Irish militant who had dominated the movement in so many ways, was driven by failure into the asylum for the insane. And incidentally, many other workers during the course of history have been driven into that course by their inability to make any progress in changing by persuasion other workers' ideas. Many workers who had placed their faith in Chartism went into a long period of apathy, a period which I would argue went from the beginning of the 1850s right the way through to the end of the 1870s, a period of apathy and complacency and conservatism within the working class movement. Engels accurately described what happened during this period. The working class of Great Britain, he wrote, for years fought ardently and even violently for the People's Charter. It was defeated, but the struggle had made such an impression upon the victorious capitalist class that this class, since then, was only too glad to buy a prolonged armistice at the price of ever-repeated concessions to the working people. In other words, the era of capitalist reformism had commenced. The capitalist class had learnt a lesson. Buy off the workers with reforms, offer them concessions, and you will gain in return their acquiescent and conservative support. But it will not surprise you, perhaps, to know that the one section of the Chartist movement which outlived the movement itself was that which adhered to the early socialist ideas of Brunt O'Brien. Indeed, even as late as the 1870s, when workers in Britain were once again beginning to be concerned about socialist ideas, the name which was revered more than any other name in the labour movement, and William Morris tells us all about this, writing in the 1880s, was Brunt O'Brien. Many workers, old men by then, coming into the Social Democratic Federation and the Socialist League in the 1880s, where did you learn your socialism from? Brunt O'Brien taught it to us in the Chartist movement. And it's not without reason that this early theoretician of the working class movement was known as the Chartist schoolmaster. As late as 1851, O'Brien's protege, Harney, who incidentally had probably far less developed ideas than O'Brien, he was publishing this journal, The Red Republican. It lasted for about 2 years in 1850. And the editorial of the issue for the 12th of October 1850 is as much a manifesto for socialists today as it was then. And this is what Harney wrote. I say for the proletarians, of whom I am one, it is not any amelioration of the condition of the most miserable that will satisfy us. It is justice to all that we demand. It is not the mere improvement of the social life of our class that we seek, but the abolition of classes and the destruction of those wicked distinctions which have divided the human race into princes and paupers, landlords and labourers, masters and slaves. It's not any patching up and cobbling of the present system we aspire to accomplish, but the annihilation of that system and the substitution in its stead of an order of things in which all shall labour and all enjoy, and the happiness of each guarantees the welfare of the entire community. Have the majority of the proletarians also authorised me to speak for them? No. Am I sure that I speak the sentiments of even a minority formidable in numbers? No. Sneer not, no doubter. My words herald the future, the mutterings of the present, but presage the hurricane roar of the coming time.